Okay, so today I will try to say something about the proofs. And so first, there will be some introduction, essentially from geometry of numbers. And so first, there is a construction in geometry of numbers how to associate a function on Rn. If we have a function on Rn, how to get a function on the space of lattices. Okay, so we start with the space of unimodular lattices. Yeah, no, sorry, it's actually n by n lattices, and so they should have discriminant 1. So this is space omega n, and this space can be naturally identified with the quotient of S ln R by S ln Z. Now, if we have an integrable function on Rn, then we can define a function psi tweedle on this space of lattices. And this is done in the following way. So we take, so G gamma will be, so actually, if G is 1, then it will be G gamma will be just Zn. And this is translation of Zn by G. And so we take the sum of the, again, there should not be this widow. Yeah, so it takes summation of the function psi over all non-zero vectors in the lattice. Okay, so now if we have so there's a theorem of Ziegler which says that if we start with this function psi and integrate over Rn, then we get an integrable function on this space of lattices, and the integral of this function psi over Rn will be exactly this integral of G mod gamma, and on G mod gamma we take the G invariant probability measure. So this is okay, so now it's so actually it's yes, so actually this is not exactly very simple, but and actually it was a so Ziegler gave another proof of the Minkowski conjecture, which had been proved before that by Hlavka. And so this is conjecture about the size of the minimum vector in almost all lattices, in most lattices. Okay, so now, yeah, if we normalize here, this is, if the mu of G mod gamma is 1, then it will be exactly equality without a constant, and this is somehow it's the main point of this. Okay, so now it's, so next step is how to define certain class of functions on this space of lattices. Yeah, so we start with a lattice in Rn, and now we consider what we call delta rational subspaces. So it's, we take linear subspaces in Rn, and it's called delta rational. The intersection of this subspace with the lattice is the lattice in L. So the quotient of L by L intersection delta is compact. So if delta is Zn, it's exactly a rational subspace. So it's, now it's for every such rational subspace, we define a number which is denoted by d delta of L, and this is will be the volume of this quotient space L by F intersection delta. Now this is, and this is an easy exercise in linear algebra, that this d of L will be exactly equal to the norm of this exterior product, d1 dl, and so we take d1 dl as a basis in this intersection, L intersection delta. So we take a basis of this lattice L intersection delta, and then we get, and it's easy to check that this norm doesn't depend on the choice of the basis. So it's, now, if it's just convention, if L is a trivial subspace, a zero subspace, then we write that d of L is by definition is equal to 1. And if the lattice is unimodular, so then d delta of Rn is 1. This is just the definition of the unimodular lattice. Okay, so after that, we define certain functions on the space of lattices, and using this d delta of L, or d of L. And so for every I which is between 0 and n, we write alpha e of delta is equal to the maximum of 1 over d of L, and we take this maximum over all delta rational subspace of dimension I. And so if, okay, so if I is 0, so then it will be just 1. If delta is unimodular and I is n is also 1, but otherwise it's rather a non-trivial function. And actually, and then we also can define this alpha of delta, which will be a maximum of alpha I of delta when we take maximum of all I between 0 and n. Now it's, and I actually, if no, no, it's not, no, it's, no, it depends, no, it would, no, it would take, if delta is exactly Zn, then it will be an integer. But delta is any lattice, so it could be, basis could be just any vector, so it's, no, it's not necessary, no, it's, in general it could be. Yeah, now it's, and actually this function alpha I of, so it's a function of the space of lattices. Space of lattices is, okay, so it's omega n, maybe just some information. So it's omega n is, if we take just unimodular lattices, it's SLNR by SLNZ. Now this space of lattices is omega n, is not compact, but there is a classical theorem which is, goes back probably to Hermite, which says that the volume of omega n is finite. So the, and the volume with respect to the Haar measure. So this is, and actually it follows also from this theorem of Zeigler and the previous transparency, but actually it's much simpler. And in fact, it's, in some sense, it's used in the, by Zeigler in his proof. Now, so this space, now if n is 2, then there is a well-known picture which is for the fundamental domain of SL2R by SL2Z. So this is, so there are some identifications, and so this is an upper half plane, and so there is some compact part, but there is also some non-compact part. So there is some part which is becomes very narrow, but exponentially narrow, but it's, but still it's, the volume is finite. Now functions alpha I, they are continuous. It's easy to see from say from this, okay, so from this, and they also proper functions. So if you would take the set of points where alpha I is less than certain constant, then it's compact. So when this lattice tends to infinity in the space of lattices, then alpha I, if I is between 1 and n minus 1, tends to infinity. So somehow, in some sense, this function alpha I, they control the behavior of this space at infinity. Okay, so now there is a theorem which is, again, don't know who exactly first proved it. Certainly there's Schmidt proved it, maybe it had been known before, which says the following. So we take, so any bounded function f on Rn with compact support, then we can construct the function f twiddle. And so this function will not be, so almost never it will be bounded, even if function f is very good. So if we take just non-zero positive function, continuous, smooth, with compact support, then this function f twiddle will be unbounded. But still there is this, but there is a bound in terms of this function alpha of delta. So in certain sense, this function alpha of delta is, it's not, there is no exact equality, but alpha of delta is, in some sense, equal to the number, it's not a number of points V in delta such that norm of V is not greater than 1. So this is not an equality, but in some sense this is, maybe using terminology from a different subject, is some kind of quasi-isometric equality. So it's the ratio, so it's, we take this, so alpha of delta is not greater than this number multiplied by some constant plus some additive constant in both directions. So this is, okay, so, and this is quite useful for our purposes. So now let's go to our quadratic form. So here I will talk about indefinite forms for a while. And now we have this quadratic form of signature PQ with this assumption that P is not less than Q and Q is not less than 1. We take, of course, the number of variables is P plus Q, and we, as before, assume that N is at least 3. Now we have this quadratic form Q, but we, for some essential technical reasons, we want to fix some form Q0, which is sum of signature PQ. And so there's some particular form, but we can choose many other quadratic forms. But let's choose this one. Okay, so this is the formula is written, so the Q0 on the vector with coordinates VI is equal to V1 VN plus, and then we take sum of the squares from VI square from 2 to P and subtract sum of the VI squares from P plus 1 to N minus 1. Okay, so now we have considered this group as a special orthogonal group which corresponds to this quadratic form Q0, and we choose certain subgroups in this orthogonal group. So we denote this orthogonal group by H. So one is will be one parameter group, which is denoted AT. So it's, so AT multiplies first vector by e to minus t, last vector by e to the t, and all other vectors in the basis are fixed. So okay, it's easy to see from the definition of the form that it's AT belongs to this orthogonal group. And then another will be one of the, we choose a maximal compact subgroup in this orthogonal group. So it's, we do this in the following way. So we take SON, so it will be in intersection this SON with our orthogonal group. And this K will be a maximal compact subgroup of this H. Now it's, one can easily see that there is a simple description of this K, so it's consists of vectors which live in variant subspace which span by vectors which are here, E1 plus EN and E2 EP. Now there is, and we choose normalized Haar measure on K. Now there is a identity which follows from essentially from the definition of this function F Tweedle, which says that, yeah, no, so it's written here. So we take, yeah, no, so I don't want to read what is written. So we take, so left hand side we take integrate over K sum of the, no, we take sum of V belonging to GZN and then integrate over K this F of TKV and with some weight theta of K, and then it's equal to the integral of the K of this F Tweedle ATKJ gamma theta of K d sigma of K. Now, this is essentially a Fubini theorem. So it's, if we take integral of the infinite sum is equal to the sum of the integrals. So just if one looks at the, unfortunately, I cannot, you know, so there's this definition of F Tweedle. So it's, so this is a, as I said, essentially Fubini theorem. But now it's, so this is a, somehow a basic identity which is used in these papers. And so the left-hand side somehow gives a rather good approximation to number theoretical quantities which we want to describe. So it's, yeah, and so we take this, okay, so it, this is, will be, say, E1, and this is EN. So now we take certain function which somehow controls, which control number theoretic properties, and if we take vector V, which has certain norm, and we translate by K and then by AT, and now we take the essentially the measure of points on K such that when we translate by AT to here, then it will be in this indicator thing. Somehow it's this indicator set. And more or less this integral which say, so if this, if we have that Q of V is the first suitable choice of this set, that if Q of V between A and B and the norm of V, let's say it's, yeah, so say norm of V will be between 1 minus epsilon T and say 1 plus epsilon T. Yeah, so this is not an exact equality, but somehow it's a good, so So the left-hand side give good approximation for the number of integral solutions of number of integral vectors which satisfy this inequality. And the right-hand side somehow has dynamical description, so it will be, so we have a certain function on G mod gamma, and we translate by, so we take G gamma, it will be a point in G mod gamma, we translate by K, and then translate by AT, and then integrate over K. So just, I will draw a picture in a moment. And now it's somehow the main, so the main new result, or main new technical result in this paper with Eskin and Moses, which I mentioned yesterday, is some integrability of certain, some upper estimates for certain integrals. Yeah, and I say again, so the proof is, so there, before that there was joint work with Dani, and this is, was heavily based on the work of Marina Ratner about, in essentially, on equidistribution theorem for unipotent flows. But that, using that theorem, it was possible to give only lower estimates, but to give upper estimates, we need this, you know, so this estimate for the integral. So now let me just say what are these estimates. So we take, can I say again, there's the assumption on P and Q, and also on this power S. So we assume that, so one of the two conditions is sort of satisfied. Either P is at least 3, Q is at least 1, and S is between 0 and 2. And, but if P is 2, and Q is again, is at least 1, then we can assume only that, we have to assume that S is between 0 and 1. So there we have weaker assumption that S is less than 2, and here S is less than 1. Then if we take the supremum of the OT of this alpha of ATK delta to the power S, then it will be, the supremum is finite. So now it's, maybe let me draw a picture which is, okay, so we start with this point which is, okay, so this is delta which is a point in G mod gamma. Now we take the orbit under K, so it will be this, so it will be a rather small set because K is compact. But then we translate by AT. So then it becomes, again, it will be again bounded, but it becomes a very big set. And now we integrate this function alpha of the, in the power S over this set, and to take the average. And the statement that when for all T we have some universal upper estimate. Now for, and exactly for that reason we can, yeah, so for applications to quadratic forms, so for example, to get asymptotics, we need for S, which is 1 plus epsilon. But we have this only under condition that p is at least 3 and q is at least 1. If p is 2 and q is 1 or 2, then we don't have this for 1 plus epsilon. Now, for when p is 2 and q is either 1 or 2, there is a slightly, there is a weaker statement that instead of taking just integral, we have divide this integral by k, and then this supremum will be still finite. Now, and somehow this factor 1 over t is somehow responsible for this additional logarithmic term, this upper estimate for these two exceptional cases. Okay, so this is okay, so now, so this was the, in some sense, the main result in this paper with Eskin and Moses. And now let me just essentially repeat, just put this picture which I tried to draw on this blackboard. And so this is here again. So it's, we start with this delta, take this k delta, it will be this, a rather small set, and then we translate this by at. Now, connection with the theory of unipotent flows is based on the following remark. So we take the picture above. So we take two points, x and yx, so y is small. And now we translate this two points by g, so g is some kind of big element. And we compare then gx and gyx. Now there is a trivial identity which says that gyx is equal gy, g inverse, and g applied to gx. Now it's so y is small and in fixed. So its eigenvalues of y are close to 1. But eigenvalues do not change under conjugation. So we have the gy, g inverse is, again, eigenvalues are close to 1. So this is almost unipotent elements. Now it's, so now here we have this k delta. So it can be, so it's a bounded set, so we can take some very small subset in this k delta and then translate by at. Then it becomes a big set, and these small pieces become also big pieces, so it will be big set. And they are, in some sense, almost coincide with an orbit of a unipotent subgroup. Now it's, according to one of the identities which I wrote, we're actually interested in the integral of this certain function f on the space of lattices over this ATK delta. Now, for bounded functions, there is this Ratner's equidistribution theorem, and so we can, more or less in our situation, it says that the integral of this big set, over pieces of this big set, which somehow almost coincide in the orbit of unipotent subgroup, it will be more or less coincide with the integral of the entire space. And then we just take some small, and there's this, some simple argument which is subdivide this in k delta into some small pieces and then take summation. But it's not possible to, so there is no analog of this equidistribution theorem for unbounded function, and therefore we have to estimate this integral of this f twiddle to actually to some power 1 plus epsilon. Epsilon is small, but it should be positive, over this ATK delta. And if we have, now there was this inequality that f twiddle is bounded by alpha of delta with some multiplicative constant. And so therefore, we can have estimates for this alpha to the power 1 plus epsilon, average over this ATK delta, then we can proceed to get this upper estimates and asymptotics. Okay, so now let me maybe for non-experts say this, so briefly remind this Ratner's result. So there is this orbit closure theorem which says that essentially closures of orbits of unipotent subgroups will be homogeneous. So now there's some short history. So there's this for horospherical subgroups, it had been known before, it's relatively simple. Now there's this also for solver groups, and there was actually related to Oppenheim conjecture, there was previous results for generic unipotent subgroups, and just for also it suggests some approach for proving Ranganathan conjecture in general, but it's somehow the main point in this number three, that these subgroups are not horospherical. Yeah, so this is a very powerful theorem. Now, it's the proof of the theorem is in Ratner's work somehow the main result, actually, measure classification theorem, which describes measures invariant under unipotent groups, so it's groups which are generated by unipotent subgroups. Again, it's this measure should be algebraic in certain sense. And somehow the main result which is used in applications to quadratic forms is this uniform distribution theorem, which says that if we average bounded continuous functions on G mod gamma over orbit of this unipotent group, so take this long interval on this orbit and divide by, again, it should be here should be capital T, then it will be tend to the integral of f of g mod gamma. Now the proof of this actually is of this theorem based on this measure classification theorem and also on previous results about recurrence to compact sets, and just let me briefly say what is there. So first there was theorem which I proved in context of the proof of arithmeticity of non-uniform lattices, which says that we have a orbit of unipotent subgroup on SLNR by SLNZ, then it can attend to infinity. Now there is a quantitative version of this theorem which is due to Dani, and which says that actually there is this recurrence occurs quite with high frequency. We take fix some big compact set, and so we fix a point x, or if we assume that x belongs to a certain bounded set, then we can find some maybe certainly much bigger compact set such that it would take all t between 0 and capital T such that utx belongs to k, then it should be greater than 1 minus epsilon t. So there's this recurrence to big compact set with the frequency which is close to 1. And this is, so in some sense, the proof of the equidistribution theorem goes, so we take, so Ratner's proof. So we take average over this orbit, so then we get a sequence of measures and take the limit of the sequence of measures, and somehow this theorem guarantees that this limit will be probability measure on G mod gamma, somehow this measure doesn't escape to infinity, And then after that is this measure classification theorem. Now it's somehow the, in some sense, the proof of this result about non-escape into infinity, and in certain sense also this about ergodic statements about actions of unipotent flows. And so very roughly it's based on the following, it uses the following simple observation. So if we take just action of the unipotent group of linear transformations and take some vector V and look, so maybe vector V which is equals to zero, and so to get the time which is needed to get from this small vector V which say belongs to B0 epsilon to the sphere of radius 1/2 requires in some sense comparable amount of time to get to the sphere of radius 1. It's completely opposite to what happens in for hyperbolic dynamics. So it's, you will replace this unipotent group by this diagonal group, then, okay, when we come to 1/2, for example, we need something, a log epsilon time, but then go from 1/2 to 1, it's just in time 1. So it's, but here it's because the norm of V, square of the norm of V is a polynomial, so we have this. Okay, so this is some statements, just a reminder about unipotent flows. Yeah, I will say nothing about the proof of Ratner's measure classification theorem, but just I want to explain something about the proof of this integrability of estimates of this kind of integrals. Okay, so the main idea of the proof is to show that first we define an operator on the space of functions. The actual functions could be on any space where this orthogonal group acts. So we take AT of FX, so we just take integral of the K, F of AT KX, and then integrate with respect to the Haar measure. Now, the main idea of the proof is to show that this functions alpha I to the S satisfy certain systems of integral inequality, and then it's this system of inequality imply the desired bound. Okay, so now there is this system of inequalities. So it's, it says the following. So it would, so we have the same assumptions about signature and about S. And it says the following. So we take, for every positive C, it's possible to find some T, and we have also this W. Sorry, possible just take, maybe just leave for 1 minute. Не, собственно. Меньше, да. And so again, so there's inequality that for every positive c, which is, and actually we need c which is less than 1, so it's, we can find certain t which can be quite big, and then we need also this w such that we have this system of inequality. So we apply this operator at to alpha I to the power s, and then it will not be greater than c over 2 alpha I to the s, and there's a sum nonlinear term, which is omega square, and then we take maximum over all j between 0 and minimum n minus r and I, and then take square root of alpha I plus j to the power s, alpha I minus j to the power s. And a little bit later I explain the nature of these both terms. Again, so now it's, there's also form this exceptional signatures to 1 and to 2, there is some similar inequalities, but unfortunately we cannot here put constant which is less than 1. So here we have this constant 1, and just because of that we somehow have to add this logarithmic term. Now there is some central calculation which shows how to get from this system of integral inequalities, so it's somehow to construct certain functions which satisfy quite nice inequalities. Okay, so let me spend some time doing that. So it's okay, so it fits this lattice delta. And then we construct a function of this orthogonal group. So we just take fi of h equal alpha I of h delta. Now this function fi came from alpha I, so it's where alpha I satisfy similar inequalities. So we have these inequalities for fi to the power s. Okay, so now our purpose is to construct a function which satisfy this inequality, so that we have just apply some at to f to certain function f epsilon s, and then it will be less than c f epsilon s, and then plus some number, and then using some kind of mean value theorem for which is standard harmonic functions, we can get some estimates. Now to construct such a function, there is a trick which is, so it's the following. So this function will be a linear combination of this function alpha I to the power s. Okay, so now how it's done. So it's, first we define q of I, which is the product of I to n minus I. And then there's this function q of I is a function, of course, well, here it's function of integers, but it's function of real variables, and somehow crucial for this is this convex function. It's concave. This is convex. Okay, and there's this expression. Now it's, if we take this inequality and multiply function fi to the power s by epsilon to the q to the q of I. Now it's somehow nothing happens with linear term. But for nonlinear terms, so it's, you know, so the problem with the original inequality is that we have this omega, which is actually could be quite big. But somehow we want to make this omega to be very small. And this is done just by multiplying this function q of I by fi to the power s by somehow different numbers. Okay, now there's this computation which shows that, okay, AT of epsilon to Q of I, Fi to the S, there's this linear term. Now, then there's this omega square. Again, we have this maximum of the J, which is strictly greater than zero and not greater than minimum of N minus I and I. And now there's this, again, there's this square root of, now here we have Q of F. Put this Q of I plus J and Q of I minus J epsilon to this. But then we have to compensate this, and then we get epsilon Q of I minus Q of I plus J plus Q of I minus J divided over 2. And then we use this equality, so J is at least 1. So actually this is, if epsilon is small enough, then it will be small number, so it's epsilon omega squared becomes small. And now we take this function f epsilon of s of h, and which is the sum of, which is this linear combination of fi to the power s with coefficients epsilon to q of the I. And then from this system of inequalities, we get that at applied to f epsilon satisfy this inequality, and then choose sufficiently small epsilon, we get that if we take this T of Sc, so it's just maybe some T, and apply to F epsilon of S, then it's not greater than C F epsilon of S, and then plus some number. Okay, so now maybe I can say something. So what is the relation to this mean value theorem? So it's, and of course there is this classical mean value theorem, so say, which says if we have a, let's say, positive function, and on Rn we take, suppose the value of the function at the center of the ball of, say, radius 1 is equal to the value at the center, then this should be a harmonic function. And then the average of any ball of radius, of any radius, should be equal to value at the center. So it's, here we have not exactly that, but we have that. So average of the sphere of radius 1, or something like sphere of radius 1, is not greater than 1, say, 1 half of the value at the center plus some constant. Now, here it's not on Rn, but on extension on symmetric spaces. For example, if this symmetric space is a hyperbolic space, so we suppose we have this hyperbolic space, and we know that we have a positive function, and we have that the value of the average of the any sphere of radius 1 is not greater than 1 half, plus value of the center plus 1, then it's somehow it's not difficult to prove that if we take average of any sphere of any radius, it will not be greater than somehow, when we have that it's average, there's some universal estimate independent, which is not, doesn't depend on the radius, and somehow some kind of variation of this shows that shows what we want to prove. So that, now it's in, so for general groups, so instead of this, you know, so there is this rather simple statement which is, says that if we take some small neighborhood of identity in this compact group and then take this double cassette ATUAR, then it's somehow it's belongs to KVATAR K. So it's So there's a so-called Cartan decomposition in every semi-simple group. So Cartan decomposition, there's a K1, some diagonal group, and K2. So then for matrices, you will have product of orthogonal group, diagonal group with positive coefficient, positive eigenvalues, and there's again orthogonal group. So there's this diagonal part. And somehow this is states if we take, so generically we take product of two elements, then diagonal product of the diagonal parts, or diagonal part of the product, is almost equal to the product of diagonal parts. Of course, it's not true in general, but it's generically it's true. And this is, so this is easy to prove, and actually it had been known for. And now combining this inequality with this observation, we get what we need for to prove this estimate. Okay, so now let me just then to this part explain what are tools to prove this system of inequalities. Okay, so there's this two lemmas. So one is essentially a lemma from linear algebra, some elementary representation theory, and it says the following. So we take this vectors x1, xi, and rp plus q, and again we have the same conditions on s and p and q, then you would take this integral of the k of 1 over a t k v to the power s, then when t tends to infinity, this limit is equal to 0. Now it's so this rather easy to prove, but let me emphasize that this is not true for this exceptional cases. And somehow let me just every time which I explain this, I usually so there's this rather simple exercise in calculus, so which is the following. Take this x squared plus y squared minus z squared is equal to 0, and take the cone. So this is the cone. Now take the horizontal section of this cone, so when z is 1, and take this vector v on this horizontal section, which is S1, and take a normalized Lebesgue measure on this S1. Now take element G from group which preserves this quadratic form, and then integrate over S1 and take V over divide the norm to GV. Now in this case, so it's somehow it happens that it doesn't depend on G and it's equal to 1. Now the explanation for this is the following. We take this V and GV and then project GV back to S1. And then we get a map of S1 to itself, and Jacobian of this map will be exactly 1 over this norm. Now it's so this is for 2-1. Now if we take quadratic form of the signature 3-1, then this would be normal GV square. But somehow we need 1 plus epsilon, so it's if we put, okay, it will be S2, and then we have this 1 plus epsilon, then it's Actually, it will tend to zero as g tends to infinity. So for no, not for this, but it will have the x square plus y square plus z square is equal to, or maybe this, okay, u square plus is equal to z square. So this is three-dimensional cone in a four-dimensional space, and we take horizontal section, then we get S2, and then we get, and somehow this is more or less the reason why for the signature-free one we have the proof estimates, and for 2-1 it's not. Now it's, and then there is another lemma which is, says that if we take two delta rational subspaces, then if we take L and M, then G of L multiplied by G of M, it will be not less than G of L plus intersection M, G of L plus M. This is essentially Adamard inequality, which says the following. If we take norm of E1, take vectors V1 and so on, VI, and then exterior product, this is W1, WJ, then this norm is not greater than the product of the norm of these vectors. Okay, so now this lemma 1 is somehow responsible for the linear part in this inequality which I wrote, and lemma 2 is for this square roots for nonlinear parts. Okay, so this is more or less how the proof goes to for indefinite quadratic forms. So it's so this is for this signature which is different from 2-1 and 2-2. Now it's for this exception for for signatures 2-1 and 2-2, there's the upper estimates, and then just in the first paper of Eskin and Moses, it's more or less using this different set of inequalities. But for this paper about quadratic form of signature 2-2 with diophantine time conditions, so it's somehow its technique is, it uses some part of these inequalities, but also use quite complicated covering theorems. Now it's somehow also plan to prove something. Let's just describe the work of Friedrich Goetzen about this positive definite form. So most of that probably I should do next time, but maybe I just start with repeat this next time, but it's probably it's worthwhile to give some short introduction now. So it's here it will be, so Q now it will be a positive definite form, and so then there this notation for we take an ellipsoid that Q of X is not greater than S. Now there's a notation which is used in work of Goetze, and so volume is standard notation, but there is a notation with volume Z of B, so this is number of integral points in a set B. Now it's somehow our purpose is to give estimate for the difference between volume of B and volume 0 of B, where B is ES. So it's, we want to show this. Now it's, you know, so first there is some kind of smoothing argument, and this is based on, you know, so actually there's some technical points which I just do it quite fast, but somehow it's not the main point of the proof, but it's essentially there's some kind of smoothing argument. So we take interval which is endpoints R square and R square plus W. Now there's this monotonicity of this volume Z of B, and because of that there's these two inequalities. So it's where this quantities V minus W of R and VW of R. And so we just average this volume Z, so number of integral points in EV over this integral J of W. And so again, so it's probably, don't be frightened by this sequence of inequalities, since of how it's, realize that it's just difficult to comprehend, just look at them first time. Now there's this, we take this average of this difference between number of integral points in this EV and the volume, and average of the J plus minus W, and then we get certain, yeah, so we have certain equalities, and now the what we really need, that there is this estimate that the absolute value of the difference between number of integral points and the volume is, can be estimated by the maximum of this function plus some constant which depends on the quadratic form multiplied by W, and then d, R to D minus 2. Now it's, again, so it's, somehow we, yeah, and it's how the main point of the proof is somehow give estimates for this R plus minus W of R. And just will be last slide today. So this is, or maybe just last two. So it's, there is this theta series for every positive quadratic form. So one can define theta series. So this is, so it's a function of z, so theta of z is equal to sum of m in zd exponent minus z to q of m. So this is a classical theta series, and now there's also theta integral, so just instead of the sum, we take the integral. Now it's, there's a rather simple argument which is, which somehow expresses this integral of this volume Z of EV when we integrate V over V between 0 and S in terms of this fit integrals. Now this is based on the following identity, which is essentially residue calculus. So we take says 1 of the 2 pi integral B minus I infinity B plus I infinity exponent Zt dz over Z squared, then it's equal to maximum of 0 and T. Now here B is positive. No, so this is residue calculus, and now just integrating this, or take sum or integrating this inequality over all vectors, we get this identities which express this integrals of volume G and this volume in terms of this theta integrand and theta function. Okay, so, and so actually let me stop here because, just, but then it's just maybe I flash the last slide and before finishing, and then it's, there is a, so using identities from the previous, we get that expression from this RW of R, and it will be some integration of a theta z of minus theta zero of z with some weight. And now the main point is how to give good estimates for that. And so how it's, so next, so tomorrow I will try to explain this, so just I, so briefly, you know, so maybe briefly repeat what I said just during the last 5-10 minutes, and then we'll go to the this estimate for RW of R. Now, so just very general remark. So this is integration of a infinite line. So usually in analytic number theory, so there's usually this kind of integral, so how it's represented the domain of integration, so how it's subdivided into three intervals. One is very small, around zero. One is somehow it's close to, you know, large, but it's in infinity, and there's some intermediate. And usually it's this first two is easy to estimate. And the main point is how to get estimate for this for the average of the intermediate interval. And for that is there's a technique, so it's Volkov-Dvetsky, there's a quite, you know, such a quite very impressive trick which is uses so Poisson summation, then it's parallelogram equality, and but then it's somehow it's after that it's reduced to estimate of the actually integrals of this alpha function of the certain intervals, and so it's so tomorrow I will do this in more details. So probably it's somehow it's my second second lecture somehow split it into second and third. So it's, and so tomorrow we'll talk about this positive quadratic form. So it's somehow it's there's a combination of two, it's called two approaches, this Poisson summation and then some kind of this estimates for averages of alpha functions.